I'm Jyothi Gupta, and this is The Pulse. It's a largely neglected public health issue. I'm talking about period poverty. It's defined as the lack of access to safe and hygienic menstrual products, education, and sanitation. A 2023 public opinion survey conducted by Environics found that 1 out of 6 Canadians who menstruate have personally experienced period poverty. This rises to 1 in 4 if their household earns less than $40,000 a year. In Canada, people who menstruate spend over $6,000 on menstrual products throughout their lifetime. Another survey, this one by Plan International Canada, found that 82% of respondents felt menstrual products were far too expensive. So it is a public health issue, albeit one that's hiding in plain sight. Today, we discuss period poverty. It's time to put your finger on the pulse. Hello and welcome to The Pulse on AMI Audio. I'm Jyothi Gupta. Joining me today is Danielle Kaftarian, the Executive Director for The Period Purse, here to talk about menstrual equity and period poverty. Danielle, hello and welcome to the program. I'm so glad you could join us today.
Thank you for having me.
Why is menstrual equity and period poverty so important to talk about?
Great question. So menstrual equity is basically having that access to period products as well as the education that's required to go along with it. And period poverty is that not having the financial means to actually access those period products that are required. So super important that we talk about these things to break down that stigma around them.
How much of this is stigma and how much of this, and I'm thinking about Gloria Steinem's, it was a tongue-in-cheek, I guess it was a poem, If Men Could Menstruate, and how, you know, a lot of these projects, If Men Could Menstruate, would be federally funded, amongst other things. How much of this comes down to a stigma and an unwillingness to talk about menstruation, and how much of it is a lack of political will to act on what is clearly a very important public health issue?
Yes. So we see a lot of stigma for those who menstruate to even talk about the issue. It's ingrained in so many folks bringing that when they, you know, they get their first cycle is, here's how to hide your products, here's how to put the, you know, tampons up your sleeve, and not give that education to it. So to actually bring it up to the forefront of the issues and the challenges that are being faced across the board with it is that first sort of hurdle that we need to pass to with when we're talking about this menstrual space. And then it's that once we do talk about it, we can start making those long-lasting changes, like, you know, putting in policies into place, putting funding into place. But we do find that it's that first roadblock of people not wanting to talk about periods to even make those changes is the thing that we need to do.
But why is it that people don't want to talk about periods? You know, we've had, what, second, third, fourth wave feminism now? It seems like it's one of those issues that should have been dealt with about 50 years ago, and yet the shame and the stigma around periods persist. Why is that?
I think it's passed down a little bit, right? So we see that sort of passed down from maybe a parent down to their child. We see things in media. There's a bit of a shift there, but, you know, up until, you know, a number of years ago, it was period products were being tested with blue liquid, right? And it wasn't until last year that they actually even started testing the absorbency of period products with menstrual blood. So we do see that stigma is sort of ingrained in there. And I think people are shy to talk about periods, right? It's a very personal thing. But we need to remember that 50% of the population will menstruate at some point. And really sort of, we all come from a period and we need to talk more about periods when it comes to that. Another component of it too is the education around it. I don't think folks get a large education on periods in school. You know, it might have been your last health class that you took in grade 5 or grade 7, where they may have glazed over periods. Sometimes those classes are segmented by gender. So all of these things kind of ingrain that stigma around it and that we don't want to talk about it, right? Even if we think of period products, they're often in the corner of a store, sort of stuffed to the side. And so all of these things add those layers of why the stigma is still there and continuing. So we really need to talk about it, be comfortable in speaking about it. And that's what's going to help break down those barriers and start getting more people engaged in the conversation and impact change.
Well, aside from the stigma piece, I'm wondering if there's also an issue around access. And I don't just mean financial access, although that's probably a big part of it, but also just in terms of having access to alternatives and options when it comes to managing your period and having conversations about what's the best option for someone.
Yes. So access is a huge issue, right? And we can probably spend the entire episode here today just talking about that word alone. So if we just at a high level discuss it, you know, we need to be able to have access into the period products for in bathrooms, in places where folks might require extra support, so like food banks and drop-in centers. And then you have that access of like what type of products are going to be available to them. So we have the products where we're talking about, you know, your regular disposables that folks know about. So there's, you know, pads and tampons. And within that, there's these different types of pads and tampons. And then we have our reusable products. So the access to reusable things like cups and discs, or reusable cloth pads and period underwear. So there's that whole how we access it and what's available out there is tons of different products. And folks don't sometimes know about it. They learn about one product and they sort of just stay with that for the rest of their time.
Mm-hmm, that's right. And why do you suppose it is that it's not something that's publicly available? We do have a system of public healthcare in this country, even if you didn't have the best and most expensive version of period products and hygiene products. Surely we could have a situation where at least some basic supplies are made available to people who menstruate. Why have we not been able to manage that in the context of a country that does, for better or worse, have a publicly funded system of healthcare?
Well, we're seeing a bit of shift. So we are seeing some products become available. So we, I think, again, it comes back to that stigma and not having the right people bring up those issues and the concerns around it. And I'm happy to share a great story with you in a moment around that. But what I think part of it for what we're seeing from the government is we're starting to see the governments at all levels take steps forward to provide products out to people. So we're seeing the federal government has a menstrual equity fund, which was a pilot fund to do research in this area and see what the impact of providing free period products. So that was money granted to Food Banks Canada, and they are just finishing up sending period products all across the country to various food banks and collecting data on who's using that product, what the impact is, and then what the impact of not having that product is, along with the education. So we're one of the education partners amongst a few other groups out there that are providing education to folks on, you know, how to use period products, what is a period, that stigma around it, advocacy work around it, so that we can see that impact in there. We're also seeing legislative changes. So we've seen now that all federal workplaces across Canada now need to provide free period products to their employees. And that has, you know, everybody sort of thinks initially of the federal government as a whole, but that also goes into, you know, airlines, our transportations, some boating stuff. So there's a lot of different things that are captured under there. And then we're seeing provincial governments starting to put in programs. So like here in Ontario, they've had free period products in schools. And we're seeing some municipalities put it into community centers, libraries, and different places like that. So we are seeing a shift. And some of that comes back to just bringing awareness. So I'll share a story with you that we do a lot of advocacy work around Menstrual Health Day, and sort of we try to light up buildings and raise flags and do proclamations. And the goal is to bring awareness for that and for all this conversation, but also we can start engaging municipalities and areas on, you know, you've said that you want to do a proclamation. So what's the impact of that? Where can we go with that? And we've seen a community that we went to do a proclamation and we spoke to the committee, and they ended up deciding that they would pass a motion to put free period products into their community centers, into their next budget. And it would all just came from a conversation and bringing awareness to it. So sometimes it's just a matter of us educating people and telling them and bringing awareness that they're like, oh, I didn't realize this was an issue. And they can do that impact and start providing free period products. Despite all those good news stories, there's still so much work to do and so many gaps that we see from, you know, where you, even if you go to the most malls or public centers, you know, as they're renovating washrooms, a lot of these places are taking out their dispensaries for period products within the washrooms, or they have the old coin ones and no one really carries change with them anymore. So there's still a lot of access issues that need to be addressed.
What about the cost of menstrual products? I mentioned just in the opening essay that the average person who menstruates over the course of their lifetime will spend $6,000 on menstrual products. That's a lot when you consider that for people who don't have to menstruate, they never have to spend that kind of money. What's being done to offset some of those costs?
Yeah, it's definitely a big financial burden, especially for those who are already stretched financially, and they might have more than one person menstruating in their households, right? We hear stories of, you know, single moms who have maybe three daughters and now needing to have period products available for their family. So it can be a big cost burden there. Where the costs, unfortunately, seem to be increasing opposed to decreasing. And this even gets harder for our northern communities, rural communities, and Indigenous communities to have access to period products in general, but also at a cost-effective method. And so it's super important that we talk about this and think about it. And for what are things that are being done for it? We're seeing interesting programs. So we're seeing, like, in the city of Montreal, they have a reusable program that you can like reimburse to offset costs. So we are seeing some interesting creative things come up there, but we're more so seeing organizations like ours having to step in and really fill in that gap for folks who can't afford period products and really build that advocacy of why it needs to be added to different budgets and different programs to fill in those gaps.
I wonder if you could speak to us a little bit about people with disabilities who might be menstruating and what some of the challenges are when we think about that community in particular.
Yes. So in general, getting period products in a public location, it's a struggle to use washrooms. So, you know, if you discover you need a product and then you have to leave your stall, let's say, go find one and then go back to the stall. When you put accessibility issues in there, you can be an extra burden of having to wait for a stall that's appropriate for them. Just, you know, switching from the toilet to maybe, say, a wheelchair and then having to switch back to get products, it causes a big challenge. And there are solutions out there that we can start exploring. There's even there's options of having the dispensers actually within the stalls. Again, and this is something that's good for everybody, but especially those who might have accessibility issues, because then the product that they require is there when they require it, and they don't have to have that extra burden of having to leave the stall for accessibility and whatnot. So, you know, that's like just one small component. And depending on the accessibility issues, there could be other scenarios. You know, we have sensitivities. If you're someone who has sensory issues, there could be different pads and different things that you need to be aware of. So there's that whole layer of conversation is large as well. And again, this is why we need to have education, talk about it, and bring the right people at the table for decisions.
When it comes to a global context, how does Canada fare when we think about period poverty? Are we doing better than the average? Are we worse than average?
I don't have an exact stat on that. I'm sure I could follow up with you on one. But I think the challenges in Canada is we don't talk about it and we don't highlight it. And I think when I talk to folks about the space of menstrual equity and and period poverty, they think it's a faraway issue in another country. And they don't realize that this is happening here in Canada, and that there's people that are making, you know, pads out of socks, using sponges, and missing work, missing school because they don't have access to period products. And it's hard for folks to kind of resonate that that is here in Canada with things. So, you know, I see us taking steps forward, and but there's other countries that are way farther ahead than us. So we look at Scotland, for example. They have a program for free period products for all of their people. And so there are countries leading the way that we can follow and learn from. But we do have a ways to go, even with the work we've already done.
I wonder what your thinking is about one product over the other. I'm sure you don't endorse one or the other, but when we think about the environmental impact of, you know, people using pads or tampons and then having to dispose of them and the financial burden, is there an argument to be made for using a menstrual cup instead? And can anyone just make that switch, or do you need some special education or training before you make use of a menstrual cup?
Yes. So, you know, the first layer is having access to period products in general. And then it's about having access to the choice of the period products that you want. So even within the disposable period product world, there are so many options that are available from, you know, from your regular manufactured ones to ones that are more smallly made. They might be biodegradable, compostable, natural material. And then you have your reusable products. So to answer your question about, you know, can anyone use a cup or, you know, a disc? Yes, folks can use that, but there is a learning curve for how to use it. You know, many people don't even know how to use a tampon. So teaching them the education of here's the cup, here's how to use it, all that knowledge with it does need to be done. And that is something that we do at the Period Purse, is teach folks how to use the reusable period products that are available. But we also have to be mindful that it might not be the right match for everybody. So, you know, many folks don't want to use insertable period products. There's also a increase of cost. So it's a higher upfront cost. So a cup can run about $40. So that can be a strain on some people's financial income, but those can last for, you know, 10 years. So, you know, once you have the ability to make that upfront purchase, you would have it for a while. But then there's also access to clean water to launder the stuff. And some folks don't have access to that or a safe space to change their period products.
Earlier in the conversation, you mentioned that people are missing work or missing school on account of not having sufficient access to menstrual products. I've heard this idea being floated about menstrual leave, at least in the employment context. And I'd be curious about what you think about that, whether you think it's a progressive move or if you think it just leads to that stigmatization of periods and the shame, because a lot of women feel like they can't say to a manager, especially if the manager is, well, someone who isn't likely to menstruate, that, you know, they need the time off because they have a bad period or they have cramps and they don't feel up to coming into work that day.
Yeah. So they you know, a menstrual leave, a menstrual day off, I've heard different things of employments doing that. And it is an interesting concept because, first of all, for the employer to do that, that means they're creating a safe space for people who are bleeding, right? So they've opened up that they're having that conversation about periods and that they're trying to be inclusive of folks who bleed. So that's, I think, a great step to support people. And having it available, but not necessarily everyone has to take it, right? So we do know that within the scope of periods, some people have very gentle periods, or they might not be bleeding anymore or choose to suspend their periods. So they might not need the periods, but then you have other people on the other spectrum who might have some very challenges with their periods. They might have endometriosis, adenomyosis, different conditions that cause really heavy bleeding, cramping, and would welcome to have a day off because those are really tricky times. So having that flexibility is definitely a trend that we're starting to see organizations go to. And I think it's a great opportunity to have that discussion as an employer.
I've heard many women say, oh gosh, or, you know, people who menstruate, I should say rather, oh gosh, you know, I don't want to tell my boss that I have a period. God knows what assumptions they'll make about me that, you know, based on the fact that I have my period, it's not something I'm comfortable doing. How do we get past all that?
Yeah, again, that comes back to stigma, right? So there's so much stigma around, we don't want to talk openly about our periods when we're having them. It's almost as if we perceive it as a weakness, right? That, you know, and all the negative stuff of you might be moody or you might be emotional. And that's should not be the case, right? We should be looking at it as a completely natural thing. 50% of the population will menstruate at some point in their lives and embrace that, right? So that's something that we should be encouraging and kind of breaking down that stigma of there is no shame about telling your boss that you're bleeding, right? It's as if, you know, we don't have shame if we have to say, oh, I just need to go use the washroom before a meeting, right? It's a biological function that everybody does and we don't think twice about it. So having our periods shouldn't be anything different.
When I started my period, when I first encountered the concept of a period, I turned to my dad and I said, what's a period? And he said, go talk to your mom. And then I have a friend who told me about how she went to the washroom, found blood on her panties and was terrified, went to her older sister and said, I think I'm dying. I don't know what's going on here. And I'm sure that, you know, every family has a horror story or a slightly comedic story about, you know, talking about periods within the family. When's the right time to do it? And how's the best way to do it?
Great question. Yes. Oh my gosh. I could tell you stories about my first time too. I think it's really just making it a matter of fact. So if we have a session for, you know, periods, how to talk to youth about it. And really it's about just making it a matter of fact, right? Not hiding your period products in your bathroom, just kind of having them there. If they ask a question, the kids ask a question, you just answer the question that they're asking. It doesn't have to go, I think folks think that when we talk about periods, we need to go into a whole conversation about sexual health and where babies come from and have this big, huge conversation. But often it's just answering the questions age appropriate. What is this? Oh, it's a pad. You know, what is this? Oh, it's a tampon. And sometimes that's all that your children are asking. And if you just kind of create that space and meeting your children as they grow with the information that they require at that point, it will really help them not have those shock and think that they're dying when they have their periods for the first time. I myself am the mother of two boys, and you know, periods are just something that it's a way of life. They've helped me with, you know, packing things and doing things, and if you just meet them where they're at and you keep educating them along the way, it's not that big shock. And that's what's really going to break down that stigma around things going forward with this next generation. And I think that they're going to get it better than we all did.
Tell me a little bit about the Period Purse and some of the campaigns that you've been working on at the moment.
Yes. So the Period Purse is a registered charity. We started in 2017. And we hand out period products to many different organizations, from food banks, shelters, drop-in centers, schools, as well as doing outreach, as well as doing education. So educating around periods and that advocacy work we talked about so we can make those long-lasting changes. So right now we're in the middle of our Menstrual Health Day campaign. So Menstrual Health Day is on May 28th of every year. And we just want to bring awareness to what menstrual equity is, what period poverty is, and all the topics around it. So all of the education and advocacy and breaking down that stigma and teaching folks more about their periods and what folks are struggling with.
And so when you say it's called the Period Purse, do you actually hand out purses with period products, or how does that work?
We used to. So we started off by our founder was saw someone panhandling one day and wanted to kind of be able to hand them out something out the window, and came up with the idea of doing like some different toiletry options and period products and packaging it all up in a purse to hand out. And sort of that's where we started from. And we did purses for a number of years. And then we started unpacking and learning that many organizations actually, although they appreciated the purse and the products that were going along with it, they really wanted, they were unpacking it, and the purses were a bit of a struggle. We had to make sure that we had the right size. We had to make sure we filled them up with things. And really at the core, people wanted the period products themselves. And so that timing of the conversation was sort of happening right when the pandemic was starting. And we discovered that a lot of people just wanted sealed products, or what we have as a period pack. So it is a combination of various types of period products into a Ziploc bag that we can hand out to organizations. And so although we don't do the purses anymore, we wanted to keep the name because it does represent sort of our story and where we...
So you're working with organizations, but not really handing things out to individuals, I take it.
No, we don't do direct to the end user. We do use organizations to help us get the product out there, but we do collect the stories from the community partners that we work with on what folks require and need, and use that data to make modifications to our
product. How do you get all these period products? Do you work with manufacturers? Do you rely on donations? What's the story there?
Yes to all of it. So we work with manufacturers for donations or to purchase products at a discounted rate. And then we do, we collect financial donations on our website, or we also collect in-kind donations, so of period products. So we also do have what we call mini drives that folks can do, and places do it all across the country where you can do a combination. So if you think of like a food bank would do a food drive, we can do collect a financial donation and have a link so you can see all of the donations that you've collected. And or you can do a product donation and collect products, count them up and donate them to a local group to you, or you can donate it to our warehouse in Etobicoke.
So Etobicoke is in Toronto, but what about people across Canada? Do you have local chapters or, you know, agencies that you collaborate with where people could drop off their in-kind donations?
We used to have chapters. We no longer do. Under the mini drive, we found for a number of reasons, it was the mini drive format's a little bit more successful, and a lot of people will do that instead. And so they can drop off the locations to a location that's nearby them in their community. And if they don't have a location, we can help them find a location in their community. And so we do that across the country that's available to folks. There are some organizations that we do ship to, but we are primarily for our outreach located in the GTA.
And can someone who wanted to make a donation donate, let's say, half a box of tampons or, you know, half a bag of sanitary napkins? They've only used half, but they've got half left over. Do you accept donations like that?
We do. As long as the individual product itself is sealed, we will accept opened boxed donations.
Wonderful. All right. Well, yep. Why don't you tell us where we can find out more? Do you have a website or social media you want to leave with us?
We do. So our website is theperiodpurse.com, and we're on all social media platforms at theperiodpurse.
Wonderful. Danielle, thank you so much for chatting with us about this today.
And thank you very much for the opportunity.
Danielle Keftarian is the executive director of The Period Purse. Well, that was a really enlightening conversation. If you have any comments about it, don't forget to leave your comments down below. And if you haven't already done so, please don't forget to subscribe so you can be notified about future episodes of The Pulse. And same for the podcast. If you're listening to the podcast version and you have not yet subscribed, please don't forget to subscribe there either. If you have any feedback about this episode or anything else you hear on the program, there's a couple of ways in which you can get in touch with us. One is by phone at 1-866-509-4545. That's 1-866-509-4545. And don't forget to leave permission for us to play the audio on the program. So if you did have some feedback and you wanted to give us a call, let us know that you're leaving a phone call for the Pulse, and we will try and find an occasion to play that on the show if you leave your permission for us to do that. You can also find us on X at AMI Audio. Use the hashtag PulseAMI, and that will indicate to us that the tweet is directed to this show. If you just want to reach out to me on X, you can find me at Jovita Gupta. I'm always happy to hear from you. And you're also welcome to send us an email, write to feedback@ami.ca. That's all the time we have for today. It was a pleasure hosting again The Pulse on AMI Audio. Mark Aflalo is our technical producer. Ryan De La Hente is the coordinator for podcasts on AMI Audio. Andy Frank is the manager of AMI Audio. I've been your host, Jovita Gupta. Thanks so much for listening.